This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on D-Day 6623. Let us not forget what happened 79 years ago as U.S. troops invaded Normandy and changed the course of World War II. And a few of them are still alive. One of the last to go in this community was Johnny Jones, a black man who came back home and couldn't even be served as a lunch counter, but he fought heroically on June 6, 1944. For the United States of America. In studio is Fred Dent. He's here to talk about the markets and the debt ceiling and much more. Your number and a reminder that First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provide signature support. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Fred Dent from Dent Wealth Management. There we go. He is here, and last Friday, after the resolution of the debt ceiling crisis, if that's what it was, and I believe it was, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went way up, the NASDAQ way up. Yesterday, not so good, and today, in the early going, the Dow's actually down just a bit. Fred, sometimes the markets anticipate what's going to happen so that when it actually does happen, it doesn't make as big of an imprint as some might think, but what do you make of the fact that it's been a rather tepid climb up after this crisis was averted?
Well, if I go back to the last time I was on the show, Jim, I guess last month, I said on the radio, pay no attention to the debt ceiling. It's theatrics, and it probably has nothing to do with the returns on the stock market. And what you observed with regard to the reaction of stocks was there's an old saying on Wall Street, buy the rumor and sell the news. And that's why it was largely anticipated in the markets price in well in advance any potential outcomes with this. The thing that's interesting that's going on in the markets right now is that we had this artificial intelligence mania going on with chip stocks and NVIDIA, and those things are going crazy on the upside. We also have the Securities and Exchange Commission beginning to get aggressive on some of the crypto-related companies. Like yesterday, they sued Binance. Today, it was announced this morning that they're suing Coinbase. Now, Coinbase is a big holder of cyber currencies, and that stock is down about 20%. So it looks like they're exercising their regulatory muscle this morning and trying to rein in some of this crypto business.
Well, it's a 136-page complaint, and then the SEC, that's the Securities Exchange Commission, by the way, says Binance had mixed billions of dollars in customer funds and secretly sent them to a separate company. And it is a case in which these stocks are not doing well. But as we know, they have been up and down and all around. Would you invest in cryptocurrency right now?
Well, no, because I do believe it's speculative. Although, while these other stocks that serve the cybercurrency market are down, the actual Bitcoin price is holding up quite well. It's around 26,000 right now. So that's all the way up from where it went down to wherever it was along in the last couple of months.
Yeah, if you time it right, you can make a fortune on this stuff. But if you time it wrongly, of course, you can lose your shirt and everything else.
Yes, we do not recommend that our clients gamble in cybercurrencies.
I wish Andy Anderson were here. I'd love to get his take on cybercurrency. Maybe we can coax him back. But he's a guy who, as we know, is not averse to taking a few risks. And Fred, I wouldn't say you're conservative, but you're diversified, which is what some would say is a more conservative approach to the market. You probably don't have the real, real peaks that some do, but you don't have the real, real valleys either. Most people are more comfortable with that kind of approach, but you tell me your philosophy rather than me putting words in your mouth.
Well, every day the news media are trying to get us gripped into their fear machine. And so they're selling fear to keep us glued to the news. And P.S., regarding the debt ceiling, while you were paying attention to the debt ceiling, the economy continued its upward chug. You didn't read a lot about that in the news. People weren't trumpeting
that
as
much. Well,
we
read about the jobs increasing. And by the way, the news media were responding to Garrett Graves and to others on the Biden team, including Shalonda Young, who led the charge, both from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and we're proud of them. And And Fred, I
and
do.
Look, they did a great job.
I would take a bit of a different thought from yours. I think if this had not happened, the markets would be tumbling right now. Now, they might go right back up, but I don't think it would have been good if there had been no agreement.
I agree, and you're probably right. But you often bring up the fact that my first day on the job was October 19th of 1987. Black Monday, the day the market dropped by 23% in one day. I was so fortunate to witness that because I saw that and realized that there were basically two types of investors in the world. You have proactors and reactors. And the reactors in 1987 freaked out and sold out. The proactors had their head down and were taking advantage of the opportunities. Proactors understand that the long-term upward march mm-hmm. of the stock market continues despite temporary setbacks. Reactors are paying attention to the latest political thing or the things that they have absolutely no control over and think that they're going to get a little extra juice out of trying to time the market.
But the media people who cover the market and everything else, generally they call it as they see it. Now, there is some bias, as we know. It's impossible to be a person without having some bias. The question is whether reporters can put that aside. And now we have some of these media entities encouraging bias, like Fox, like MSNBC. So the world has changed in that realm, and I think almost every major news outlet, both print and broadcast, has noted a decrease in viewers, listeners, and readers in most cases because we no longer have Donald Trump around, and Trump, despite his somewhat tortured presidency, was good for media because people wanted to know what was going on. And the media were not, I would say, charitable to Trump. They were all over him for most of it, or in Fox's case, all in. So sometimes people who are not popular with the media actually are good for business for the media, Mr. Fred Dent.
Absolutely. The media are a business, pure and simple. If they do not have viewers, they cannot sell ads and they cannot prosper. And they cannot profit. So it is in their interest to find their audience, build that audience. And whether they do it from a alignment with a particular ideology or just sell negative news or keep people glued to the screen in one format or another, reality shows, whatever it is, they're in business. And we have to keep that in mind. One of the things that I encourage people to do is pay attention to what you, the listener, are attracted to. What is it that, what channel do you watch? Why do you watch it? What is it that channel is confirming about your own bias that attracts you and keeps you coming mm-hmm. back so that you continue to feed your own internal dialogue?
Well, most people watch and read things that reinforce their beliefs, but one of the reasons Rush Hudson Limbaugh III was so successful were a lot of liberals listened to him, and apparently just to get juiced up. They wanted something to get upset about, Fred Dent, and he got them upset. And sometimes we look at things, at least I hope we do, to try to expand our minds, not be one-dimensional. I think we should expose ourselves to all points of view. That's
Absolutely.
What our show is all about.
I wake up in the morning and I read 5 different newspapers from all sources. And I don't consume any television news anymore. Mm-hmm. I find that I've lost patience for them to actually feed me the news stories. I don't have time to wait around to see what they're going to highlight.
Well, depends on what you're watching, of course. But 877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org. And a listener, this is a good question from Jessica in Donaldsonville, asking about your philosophy when you buy an individual stock. What kind of research do you do? What kind of background is appropriate when you're deciding whether to buy a stock?
Let me go back 35 years to when I first got in the business. I did buy individual stocks. That decision was primarily determined by the firm that I worked for at the time, who would issue research reports and opinions on those stocks. Today, you have so much more information available for free on the internet. We don't buy individual stocks. We use exchange-traded funds that typically hold a multitude of stocks within a particular sector, or a mutual fund that does the same. We got out of the individual stock picking game.
You're just not into that.
I'm not into it, but it's interesting to pay attention to because so far this year, Jim, the S&P 500 is up 11% while you were paying attention to the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And that rise has been led by seven stocks, seven technology stocks. If you take those seven stocks.
Well, the NASDAQ is up this year.
Indeed, yes. But if you take those seven stocks out of the S&P 500, the S&P 500 is flat to slightly down.
Well, there you go. So if you got those seven stocks, you're doing well. Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Carol, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah. Back in 87, I was at 60 Wall, and I had two takeaways from it. One is the vendors sold out, the street vendors all sold out by 10 o'clock. And two, the people that was complaining about their mutual funds being too conservative changed their tunes that day.
Yeah, it's funny. You were at 60 Wall. I knew you looked familiar because I was at 60 Broad Street on that day. And if you remember, it was a day that was a crisp, beautiful morning. I don't think there was a cloud in the sky. I had one suit, one shirt, one tie, and $12 to my name. And it was off to the races. But it was good to be there.
And it was his first day, but fortunately for us, not his last. Thank you, Fred Dim. Always a pleasure. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing today. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Dan Moldea is with us. He's written a plethora of books about all matters in the United States, much of it controversial, and one of those is The Killing of Robert F. Kennedy, an investigation of motive, means, and opportunity. And Dan actually interviewed one Sirhan Sirhan more than once, and we'll talk with him about this date 55 years ago when 42-year-old Robert Francis Kennedy, fresh from winning the California primary, died from wounds inflicted the night before at the Ambassador Hotel, 3400 Wilshire Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. Bobby Kennedy died at Great Samaritan Hospital, not so far away from there. And the question remains whether he would have won the 1968 election. He was well positioned, and as we know, Hubert Humphrey lost a cliffhanger to Richard Milhouse Nixon, and Hubert Humphrey would have been the first and only LSU graduate to be president of the United States, but it did not happen. Dan Moldea will talk about that, but this also, as I mentioned in the open, is D-Day, and it was on this date 79 years ago that U.S. troops invaded Normandy and changed the course of World War II. And Dan, it is curious, I remember when we had the 50th anniversary of D-Day, in 1994, Bill Clinton was president. He was 47 years old, and he was not alive when D-Day happened. And today is the 79th anniversary, 30 years later, and the president we have today was alive when D-Day happened. Biden is actually 4 years older than Clinton, which means that we had a young man in office in 1994 at 47, and we have an old man in office now who will be 81 in November. And Biden the other day, of course, fell down again, but right after he should be taking a victory lap on this debt ceiling negotiation. What are your thoughts about whether he can stay the course and be viable for 2024, and if elected beyond that, and leave office at the age of 86?
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Fine.
Sad day, the 55th anniversary, as you said, of Robert Kennedy's death. With regard to Biden, I think Biden has the potential to be the greatest one-term president we've ever had. And I wish that he would settle with that acclaim and that he would step away now. I think the only person he can beat in the Republican field who has a chance is Donald Trump. And I think that if anybody else comes up against him, and I'm particularly afraid of the governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, and that's the person I'm most afraid of. I think he is the most formidable among the Republican candidates because he portrays himself as being a moderate, a man of compromise, when in fact he's just another right-wing knuckle dragger. But Joe Biden, I it's very hard for me to watch him walk. It's very hard for me to watch him talk and listen to him talk. I like Joe Biden. I always have. I've never met him, but I've always had great respect for him. But I wish he would step aside now and let somebody else, with the time we have left between 2024, to take on whichever Republican they're going to throw up against us.
Again, 877-217-5757 is your number. And Dan's been around for a few presidential elections. He was 18 years old in 1968 when Robert Francis Kennedy was killed by Sirhan Sirhan. And through the years, we've had Dan on, and Dan fervently believes, as does your truly, that there was a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. But on the Robert Kennedy front, many are saying there was a conspiracy, but you, who interviewed Sirhan Sirhan at least twice, I believe, you say no conspiracy. Why do you not believe that that more people than Sirhan were shooting in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel on June 5th, 1968?
Well, there were a bunch of the critics aren't completely blamed. The critics, the people who created the conspiracy theories, can't be wholly blamed for what happened. I mean, there were some real bad official law enforcement mistakes which led to the conspiracy theories. For instance, the FBI in their crime scene report, which came out shortly after the murder, had photographs with circled holes, and they indicated that these weren't alleged bullet holes or reported bullet holes. They were, in fact, bullet holes in the walls and door frames in Sirhan's line of fire. Four bullet holes identified as such. The problem was is that Sirhan had an 8-shot revolver, a 22 Ivor Johnson. And, you know, I'm not a ballistics expert or a firearms identification expert. I don't know a land from a groove, but I do know this. An 8-shot revolver can't fire more than 8 bullets. And according to the LAPD, Sirhan had made good on all 8 shots. He'd shot Kennedy 3 times. And there were 5 other victims from which they pulled 1 bullet out of each. 8 bullets. And he had no time to reload. So it was that report by the FBI which launched, you know, scores of conspiracy theories. It wasn't until I came along and with my 1995 book about the murder where I completely and totally and convincingly discredited that FBI report and showed that it was based on nonsense, that the FBI special agent who wrote the report did a very sloppy job of it, and that the person who identified these bullet holes at the crime scene, or these holes at the crime scene as bullet holes, was an assistant hotel clerk at the Ambassador Hotel. So it was really the law enforcement screw-ups in the Robert Kennedy murder case which led to the conspiracy theorists. And yes, I agree with you, Jim, about JFK's murder. I think Sirhan did it and did it alone. No ands, ifs, or buts about that. Yes, I agree with you, JFK murder. I believe that the JFK murder was a conspiracy. It was a mafia conspiracy. Jimmy Hoffa, the president of the Teamsters Union, Carlos Barcelo down in New Orleans, and Santo Trafficante, the mafia boss of Tampa, Florida. I think they arranged, they engineered it, they executed it, and I think that the JFK murder in 1963 was a straight mob hit, whereas the RFK murder was Sirhan acting, doing it alone and acting alone.
Now, a listener notes, that NPR reported earlier this week that in 1968, Bobby Kennedy didn't even have Secret Service protection at the time. And here his brother had been blown away, and he is extremely vulnerable walking through a kitchen in a crowded hotel. There had to be some massive incompetence to allow this to happen.
Bobby Kennedy, you know, God bless Bobby Kennedy, but he was deeply affected by the Watts riots in 68 in
65,
in
wasn't it?
So, I'm sorry, 65. And he didn't want any police presence around him. That was Bobby Kennedy's choice. He had one bodyguard there, and it was a FBI agent named Bill Berry, who was unarmed. And he was just simply on the wrong side of Kennedy when Sirhan launches attack on the senator. And there was just nothing Bill Berry could have done, even though he was guilt-ridden about it for the rest of his life. The Secret Service protection came out began as a result of Bobby Kennedy's murder. So top presidential candidates after Bob Kennedy was murdered in June 1968 were afforded Secret Service protection.
And you interviewed Sirhan, and you didn't find him to be a pleasant fellow. You've expressed your belief that he's...
No, I liked him. He and I are the same religion. We're both Eastern Orthodox. We're both of the Eastern Orthodox Christian faith. And I thought he was a nice guy. He was very articulate. He was a little guy. And I thought he was very pleasant, very articulate. He looked good for a guy who's been in jail for all the time that he's been in jail. But that final interview that we had, that third and final interview, which were his brother Adele, a very fine person, was the only eyewitness. It was a very hostile. I really went right for Sirhan's throat during that interview. And when it was done, and the smoke cleared, it was. And Newsweek has described it as absolutely chilling. It was a chilling interview, and in fact, it was. I was just convinced that Sirhan did it, and he did it alone. There was no ands or buts about it, no question about it. In fact, since then, you know, Sirhan has not only was he convicted of the murder in 1969, but he has since confessed to it as well.
877-217-5757. We have some folks waiting in line to talk with Dan, so please stay with us during the break. But we do have to pause and take care of some matters here, and it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Dan Muldea is with us, and among his many books, The Killing of Robert F. Kennedy, An Investigation of Motive, Means, and Opportunity. And it was on this date in 1968, 55 years ago, that Bobby Kennedy died at 42. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Dan Muldea, the intrepid reporter in the Beltway, is with us, and we're talking about a few matters, including the death 55 years ago today of Robert Francis Kennedy, dead longer now than he was alive. He was only 42. And to show you the Kennedys and their propensity for tragedy, three brothers all killed serving the United States, Bobby Kennedy, John Kennedy, and the older brother, who might very well have been the one to inherit the flame and be the president, Joe Kennedy. They all died young. Joe was 30. So Teddy Kennedy served in the U.S. Senate 47 years, longer than any of his brothers lived. 877-217-5757. John in Mid-City, you're on with Dan Muldea. Hello, John.
Hi. I have not listened to the whole interview. Shame on me. So this might have been brought up. Do you think that Robert Kennedy would have been elected president had he not been assassinated? Thank you.
Thank you, John.
That's a very good question. And the answer is Hubert Humphrey, whom Jim mentioned in his introduction, had the votes necessary to win the nomination. There would have been a floor fight at the 1968 Democratic Convention, which all of us knows turned into a massive debacle because of the Chicago police. And Jim, I'm sure you could speak to that. But it would have been an even more contentious fight at the 1968 Democratic Convention had Robert Kennedy gone there to challenge it on the basis of his victory in California. Hubert Humphrey had the votes, so Kennedy would have had to wrestle it away from him, which would have completely divided the party.
877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org. We'll return to the phone lines in a moment, but a listener asks about a rumor, and I've heard it, and I know Dan has, that Bobby Kennedy Jr., who's running for president right now as a Democrat, might be on the short list of potential running mates for one Donald John Trump. Is there any validity to that? Could you see that happening?
Bobby Kennedy Jr. is a screwball, and he's a nutcase. I know this guy. I've talked to him. He's called me a couple of times to talk about his father's murder. And the first time he called me, it was like he had read my book, and he wanted me to know that he thought that there was more to the story and that Sirhan didn't do it. And then the second time he called me in April of 2018, he wanted me to know that he had gone to visit Sirhan in prison and that he had spent a couple hours with him and was absolutely convinced that Sirhan was innocent, that he was an innocent man wrongly accused. And I told him at that time, I said, Bobby, this is the guy who killed your dad, you know, and I warned him about credibility problems and everything else. Well, he has now gone off on a tangent now on his father's murder, claiming that the security guard at the RFK murder, Thane Eugene Caesar, a security guard whom I spent hundreds of hours with, recording interviews with him. I had him polygraphed and everything else. Gene Caesar is an innocent man wrongly accused. But Bobby Kennedy insists that it's Gene Caesar who killed his father. So we were trying to arrange, he had a production team together, and Bobby Kennedy wanted to interview Gene Caesar, and I was the conduit for it. And they wanted to interview him in the Philippines, where Gene Caesar lived. I'm telling the story for the first time here. And Caesar said he wanted $10,000 for the interview. They're going to waste his time with this. He wanted $10,000. They agreed to it. And then he said, but he would only do it on a Zoom. He didn't want to do it live and in person. So they offered him $25,000 to do it live and in person, and Caesar went along with it, even though he had been ailing and everything else. So I asked for nothing for myself except for travel expenses, because out of my mentor was Walter Sheridan, who was like a brother to Bob Kennedy over at the Justice Department when he was Attorney General. And I did everything I could to make this happen. It fell apart because of the bad faith of Bobby Kennedy and his team. And now Bobby Kennedy's going around saying that I blew this thing up because Caesar demanded $25,000. That is a total and complete lie.
Could he be Trump's running mate, though?
You know, I can't imagine in a million years that would happen. But, you know, Kennedy Jr. is a screwball enough where he could possibly pull something like that off. And Donald Trump, I don't even think Donald Trump's going to be part of the landscape. When this is all said and done, I don't even think he's going to be around. I think he's going to have so many legal problems and everything else that I just don't see him survive everything that's about ready to happen to him, whether it's at Georgia, whether it's on it's by the special counsel, the DOJ. I don't think Trump is going to be there at the end.
He has been counted out before, Dan.
By me too. Yes, I believe the Bob Mueller investigation was going to really take him to task, and clearly it was not, because that whole Mueller investigation was sabotaged by Bill Barr, the Attorney General at the time.
All right, Patrick in Innisfil Estates. Patrick, you're on with Dan Moldea. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning. Definitely agree with Dan that Sirhan killed RFK, but I think it hurts your credibility when you then turn around and say that there was a big conspiracy to kill JFK when all the evidence proves Oswald did it, and I think it does a disservice to history.
All the evidence shows that Oswald did it. Really? Okay. Well, let me tell you what happened. I came out with a book in 1978 called The Hoffa Wars, and I alleged that Hoffa, Marcello, and Trafficante, for the first time, had arranged and executed the murder. The U.S. House Select Committee on Assassinations, only the second group outside the Warren Commission, did a complete investigation of the JFK murder. And when they came out with their final report a year later, in July 1978, they concluded Hoffa, Marcello, Trafficante had motive, means, and opportunity to have the president killed. The chief counsel of the committee, G. Robert Blakey, the world's expert on the mafia, said the mob did it. It's a historical fact.
All right. Well, what about the debt ceiling crisis being averted? Joe Biden took a victory lap, kind of, before he fell down, and Kevin McCarthy took a victory lap, and this was one of those rare cases, Dan, like the old days in which we had Democrats and Republicans voting for it and Democrats and Republicans voting against it. It was a bipartisan moment in an era of nonpartisan or highly partisan votes in Congress. What do you think?
I'm a centrist. I believe you run from the center and you govern from the center. I think that's the way government works. And I thought this was a good moment, but I think Biden played it beautifully. Once again, greatest one-term president we've ever had. And he gave McCarthy, who I, you know, my thoughts about McCarthy are well known. I can't stand this guy. I think he's completely compromised by the nutcases in his party and in the House, the Freedom Caucus. But somehow McCarthy was able to get these people to be reasonable. And I think Biden was excellent in the way he complimented McCarthy and his ability to do what he had to do in order to get this debt limit passed. I give so much credit to both of these guys, actually, grudgingly to McCarthy, but especially to Biden, because he shared the credit. He didn't grab it all for himself. Once again, the greatest one-term president we've ever had.
877-217-5757, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Dan Moldea.
Good morning, gentlemen. To show you how elections have consequences. Did you know that Brett Kavanaugh was one?
You're fading on us, Phil. You need to quit moving. I think you're moving around.
I'm sorry.
Brett, what about Brett Kavanaugh? What about him?
He was one of the Republicans in suits who went down to Florida and banged on the glass to change that vote.
All right. I think that is true. That was 2000. He had Roger Stone egging him on, and Kavanaugh's in that group. But now he's a Supreme Court justice, Dan Mulder.
Kavanaugh was in that group.
I think so. Well, he was involved. He was involved in the case. I don't know if he was one of them banging on the group,
maybe,
or banging on the door.
I don't think he was part of that.
But he was involved in the Bush Gore controversy.
I'm pretty sure it was Bush who appointed Kavanaugh to the appellate court. Here, the D.C. Circuit, and but I don't remember him being part of that whole Roger Stone crowd down there beating on the glass. I don't remember that. You know, I provided information to the Senate Judiciary Committee when Kavanaugh was nominated. And it was about his role as a young prosecutor working for Ken Starr during the Clinton impeachment process. I was doing a book on Vince Foster's suicide, and so I was dealing with Ken Starr's operation, and they told me I was asking for information. I needed to know whether a second investigation of Vince Foster's suicide, and it was a suicide, was going to be happening. And they said, well, let us talk to you about, we could give substantive information from somebody on our staff. And I said, who's that? And they said, Brett Kavanaugh. And I said, oh, okay, well, who's he? And so they explained him to me and everything. I met with Kavanaugh, and he gave me what I believed was grand jury information, which violated 6E tenant. And I've never revealed what he told me during that conversation, but I did file an affidavit back in 1998 with Judge Norm Holloway Johnson during the impeachment process, which, as you know, Jim, I was deeply involved in. And then also I filed one in 2018 when he was nominated for the Supreme Court. But instead of dealing with the clear evidence we had of Kavanaugh's role in illegal leaking, they decided to go for the sex angle, which completely fell apart because they had zero evidence or zero credible evidence of what was going on.
All right. Well, the Miami Herald reports that in 2000, with the Florida vote still undecided because of a state-mandated recount, Kavanaugh was on the Bush legal team, and they successfully stopped the ballot recount on the state by a 5-4 vote of the U.S. Supreme Court, of which Kavanaugh is now a member. But I don't know, and I have some skepticism that he was actually banging on the door. I don't think that's...
Those are hardcore political activists who did that. What you said, I didn't know that he was on the legal team for Bush, but that makes sense to me. But the gentleman was right. I mean, you know, he may not have been beating on the window, but he definitely had a position on this thing, and it was an anti-Gore position.
We're back after this. We are wrapping it up on Talk Louisiana with Dan Muldea, and on deck is Amy Brady, an outstanding writer, executive director of Orion Magazine, and her latest book is Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. Dan is with us despite a busy day today. He is a guy who reveres writers, and particularly the authors of books, and you salute people who write books on a regular basis, and this is one of those days, isn't it, Dan?
It is. Twice a year we have our author's dinner group, and tonight I host it, and tonight we've got a big dinner. About 60 authors will be there, and we've had a lot of great people there. Robert De Niro even came to one of our dinners, and which was a lot of fun. He was a great sport, and he couldn't have been nicer to us.
And he just had a child.
He had Al Pacino. Yes,
yeah, Pacino at 82 and De Niro at 78. So,
well, I hope they're playing catch with their kids when their kids are 18 years old. I would love to see that.
I wouldn't discount that prospect. Finally, a listener asks about the presidential election of 68, which we started with, and Bobby Kennedy died on this date in 1968. He might have been the Democratic nominee, but he would have had a tough time getting the Democratic nomination from LSU's Hubert Horatio Humphrey. But the big issue in that race was the Vietnam War, and Nixon said he had a secret plan and would end the war in 6 months. Well, that secret plan didn't work very well, and there is now evidence that Nixon interfered in the Paris peace talks, too. But But what is going to be the big issue in 2024? Right now, we're talking a lot about Donald Trump. Will he be the issue, or will it be the culture war, or will it be the economy? What is the major issue in your view, Dan?
It's going to be abortion. The people who are going for gay rights, that's going to be a big issue. I still think the biggest issue of all will be Donald Trump and his bad behavior after the 2020 election, the January 6th insurrection and everything else. The Republicans so many of the Republicans continue to defend this traitor to our country. And I feel that that is going to be a major issue. The Republicans are going to have to come to account in 2024 for the defense of Donald Trump.
All right. Henry at the Country Club. Let's slide him in before we go to Amy Brady, who's on deck. Henry, please be concise.
I will, Mr. Jim. Hello, Mr. Dan. I was wondering if you could expand on the role that Mr. Frank Regano, who I had the pleasure of meeting when he was doing some time in Carville here, played in the Kennedy assassination.
Good question. I knew Frank very well. And I asked Frank that exact question, and what Frank told me and what he also said in his book, you know, a couple of years later, was that Frank Regano represented Santo Trafficante in Tampa. He represented Carlos Marcello in Louisiana, and he represented Jimmy Hoffa, the president of the Teamsters Union. And Jimmy Hoffa went to Regano and asked him if he would get Trafficante and Marcello together and get him to kill President Kennedy. And Regano took the contract down to Marcello and Trafficante, and he gave them that information. And whatever happened after that happened, I believe, once again, as I said first, in 1978 in the Hoffa Wars, Hoffa, Marcello, Trafficante arranged and executed the murder. As Bob Blakey said, the mob did it. It's a historical fact.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure, Jim. See you soon.
Will do. And we're with Amy Brady. She is mentioned as an outstanding writer who is one of the world's authorities on the climate crisis. And she has written about this as co-editor of The World as We Knew It, Dispatches from a Changing Climate. And this book is about ice and the unexpected and unexplored ways that ice has transformed a nation, from the foods Americans eat to the sports we play, to the way we live, what its future might look like on a swiftly warming planet. And good morning to you, Amy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, our pleasure. And you believe various industries were either invented or reinvented by ice on demand. And let's start with the climate. You believe it has been affected immensely by, quote, ice. Tell us what you mean.
Sure. Well, after the launch of the American ice trade about 200 years ago, which completely transformed how Americans think of ice and cold, we saw the rise of electric refrigeration and air conditioning, both of which we would not have without ice. Well, today there are approximately 110 million electric refrigerators in operation here in the United States, most of which have automated ice makers. And all of them are drawing energy that ultimately spews tens of millions of units of carbon into the atmosphere every year. And all of that carbon is contributing to the global warming scenario we find ourselves in now.
The book is Ice, From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity. From the machinations of 19th century ice kings and the introduction of mixed drinks on the rocks to America's first ever indoor ice rink, to palate revolutionizing delicacies like ice custard and iced tea, to the ubiquitous ice machine in every motel in the United States, ice on demand revolutionized modern life that's easy to forget. It wasn't always this way. Amy Brady, what about alcohol? Ice and alcohol, certainly a connection there, isn't there?
Well, there certainly is. I will never argue with the deliciousness of a nice drink on the rocks. but alcohol actually played a huge role in launching the American ice trade. So back in 1806, when Frederick Tudor, who was the man who launched the ice trade, got the idea to sell ice from his Massachusetts lake to warm climates around the world, what he suddenly realized was that people living in areas where ice rarely, if ever, formed naturally wouldn't just know what to do with the stuff. He had to show them in real time how to use ice to, for example, make the most delicious things like ice cream and fancy cocktails that use ice. And after demonstrating how to make cocktails with ice, the commodity took off and we became the nation that we're obsessed with the stuff that we are today.
Trish in Grand Coteau, you're on with Amy Brady. Hi, Trish.
Good morning. I grew up in the 50s in a little town out in the desert in California, and we had an ice house. And when we went camping, we would go to the ice house and get big blocks of ice to put in the cooler. And my mom always called the refrigerator an ice box because she was born in 1914, and they really did have an ice box.
All right. Thank you, Trish and Amy. I know you've heard anecdotes like that a few times.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, oh, absolutely. You know, ice houses were a part of the infrastructure that made the ice trade possible. Ice houses were essentially deep wells that went into the earth several feet, where if ice was packed appropriately, it could last almost year-round, even in the summer months. And, of course, those ice boxes are the precursor to refrigerators. Americans had those before electric refrigeration to keep their perishables cold. Mm-hmm.
Well, as Amy has noted, there are more than 100 million refrigerators in America, most of which contain automatic ice makers spewing what is reported to be 60 million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere annually. So it is a issue in a warming planet. But on the plus side, ice has certainly been used for science and medicine, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Ice transformed how we practice medicine in the United States. You know, prior to the ice trade, there was actually a strong suspicion among American doctors of cold. The thinking of the day was that it was cold that made people sick, not heat, even though hundreds of people would pass out in a hot theater because of the heat. But once they got their hands on ice, their notion of cold changed. They realized that cold could reduce swelling. It could be used as a form of pain control. It could reduce fevers. And then as experimentations grew, it led to breakthroughs like cryotherapy, which is now being used to fight cancer, and hypothermia, which is when used in a medical setting, can actually preserve human organs even after a heart attack so that the patient has a chance at survival.
Well, Amy, as we deal with more climate issues, are we going to have to be less reliant on our affinity for ice for all matters of life?
Oh, well, I don't know if the American people will ever give up their love of ice. So probably not. But the good news is that there are studies being done on new types of refrigeration technologies that utilize magnets and something called plastic crystals, which mimic how refrigerant gases and liquids, which our refrigerators use today, it mimics that. And so, but they do so without spewing carbon into the air. They're much more energy efficient. And if we can scale up this technology, it could be transformative.
Well, the book is Ice, appropriately, from Amy Brady, and it has a number of great anecdotes. 1818, for example, a guy named Augustus Jackson, after working in the White House kitchen during the Monroe administration, a free black man, he opened his own confectionery in Philadelphia featuring ice cream made only from the purest ice from his own ice house. And Amy, congrats on your book. Thanks for joining us. Nice talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Signature support for our show from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Until tomorrow, for Robin Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.